And the culmination of doing away with the boredom was what I called a ride around the block. I thought, well, you know, I got an idea to kind of make it interesting after the church is over. So I'm going to create a ride around the block. Have I ever told you guys about the ride around the block? Never? Oh, okay. Well, you'll like that. Anyway, it's my first car. It was a 1951 Chevy Powerglide. It wasn't really hot, but I had to make the best of it. And so I thought, well, I'm going to create a ride. It's going to scare the bejesus out of these guys. So the first thing I did is I practiced everything first. First thing I did, I went to the Letha school there, and before the Letha school, there was a bunch of tulies there and weeds and on the side of the road, and they were about this high. And I researched into it where I could drive off into these without doing any injury to the car or the passengers. Okay, and so I thought, well, this would be a good spot to really do the work. And then I went to the school grounds, and on the baseball field, I peeled around and experimented with there. And then I went to several places, a place where there was a bunch of junk cars and stuff, and a gravel road. And I practiced on this gravel turn where I hit it, and then the car would, like, spin around, and then I could correct it. And I got that down pretty good. And then to top it off, there was this beat dump, and they had these scales there. And on the beat dump, where the scales were, there were metal facilities on each side, and then there was this scale. And I drove up there, and there was about this much distance between the car and the metal railings, you know. So I had to be pretty careful. And as I found, I drove up there. As I was approaching the space there, it didn't look like there was enough space between these two metal sides for me to get through. It looked like they'd scrape off both sides of the car. So I practiced going up there and so that I could safely maneuver and then go to the other side. And it was pretty strong drop-off, a little bit like Dukes of Hazzard, where there was a significant drop-off after you got there, but on the other side of the scale. So anyway, I practiced all these, and I figured, well, I'm pretty sure I won't have an accident if I go through this. So anyway, after church one day, I told my friends, I said, you know, a bunch of them were gathered outside waiting for the parents to take them home, and I says, would you guys like a ride around the block? And they said, what's a ride around the block? I said, well, hop in my car and I'll show you. Back in those days, they didn't worry about seat belts. There was about 10 kids hopped into that car, you know, and they were just stuffed in there, you know. And so I took off toward the school and got up to about 70 miles an hour. And just out of the blue, I just drove right off the road into this, all these weeds and growth there. And you should have heard them. I mean, they were screaming so loud it hurt my ears. Maybe that's why my hearing isn't so good today. But anyway, then I drove back on the road and went to the school and drove around there. And then I hit the this dirt corner and slid around there, and then they started screaming again. And then when we got to the bead dump, when we went over those scales, that was a coup de grace. I mean, I thought, well, I go a little faster than I went earlier, since these guys are really into let's see what we can do here. And I went over that, and it just flew over. And as we approached, you should have heard everybody. They were just screaming so loud. Ah! And I thought, after we survived the beat dump and headed back, I thought, boy, you know, these guys are never going to be wanting to ride with me again. I mean, they'll probably want to distance themselves from me. Anyway, we got back, and everybody piled out of the car. And there's some other kids there. And they says, what have you guys been doing? He says, we went for a ride around the block with Joe. They says, what's a ride around the block? He says, we can't tell you. He says, you have to experience it. It was the greatest thing we've ever experienced. He says, really? Well, we want to ride around the block. So I gave them a ride around the block, too. But anyway, those are some things I did to counteract what I considered the boredom of of the church. And anyway, after the 6 weeks was over, of course, the ride around the block occurred after the 6 weeks, but after the 6 weeks was over, I decided, well, you know, I think I can handle it, so I guess I'll keep going. So I went going until we encountered some problems with the general authorities, not accepting some of the beliefs of me and Curtis. So, but outside of that, until that happened, I was handling it pretty good. But anyway, I've always been a searcher, and even when I was a member of the church, I was looking at unusual books. When people used to visit me, like the home teachers and different things, and looked at my bookcase, and you know, you go into a typical Mormon house, 90% of the books are Mormon related. But in mine, 90% of my books were oddball books, you know, like Is There Somebody Else on the Moon, or or Mysteries of the Past, or something like that. Eventually, I had a lot of books on self-improvement also, which was good. But anyway, I began to search all kinds of things. And then when I come back from my mission, I went to school in Moscow, and Lewiston, Idaho was about 30 miles away, and I was visiting a bookstore there, and I was looking in the New Age section, and this guy, the bookstore manager, come up to me for some reason, and he noticed the section I was in, and he says, you'll probably like this book, and he pulls down an Alice A. Bailey book, Cult Meditation, and handed it to me. He says, you would probably find this book interesting. And I opened it up and looked through the titles of the other books written by the same author, and it said like Treatise on Cosmic Fire, Rays and Initiation, Occult Healing, different things like this. And I thought, wow, these are, what in the world is Cosmic Fire anyway? You know, that sounds kind of interesting. So I bought the book and I took it home to my digs there where I lived, in a fire station at that time. And I read through about 20 pages and I thought, wow, this, whoever wrote this is extremely intelligent. But it goes against some of the things that the church teaches. So I kind of put it on the shelf and didn't read any more from Alice A. Bailey for, 4 or 5 years later. So I kind of reached a crisis point in my life, and I thought, I'm going to try something else. And I bought one of her books on Treatise on White Magic, and I determined to read it all the way through to find out if there was anything there for sure. And I read it all the way through, and that got me hooked on it because of the tremendous light that was in it. White magic has turned out to be totally different than I thought it might be. white magic is really the magic that Christ used to heal people with and perform his miraculous things. That's what he termed as white magic. And he tells in this book how to be able to accomplish the principles behind the true white magician, which is totally different than the black magician. So anyway, I began to gather a lot of things, not only from these books, but from the scriptures. The church always told me to read the scriptures and learn from them. So I took their advice and I read from them, and I determined a lot of things from the scriptures, like I figured out where the lost tribes must be and different things like this. Also, the scriptures seemed to teach reincarnation, and they taught a lot of interesting mysteries were in there that I had found. And so in a way, what led me to higher ground more than anything else was the scriptures themselves that seemed to hold everybody else in kindergarten. The great part about the scriptures is they have all kinds of things in them that are actually quite deep, can take you to a higher spiritual level. So anyway, I made all these discoveries, and I thought, boy, I wish I had somebody to teach all these things to. And so I started testing people. Whenever I found an LDS person that I thought was searching, I would ask about one of the greatest Mormon mysteries, which in the Mormon church, one of the greatest mysteries is, where in the world are the lost 10 tribes? Okay. The thing is that the general authorities discourage seeking these mysteries. They tell us not to delve, and when the time comes, the revelations will come, so don't worry about it. But I was concerned about it, and I thought if somebody's really searching, they would want to know where the lost 10 tribes are. So whenever I found somebody I thought was a little above average in seeking in the church, I would ask them, you ever wonder where the lost 10 tribes are? And the answer I usually got was, well, you know, we're going to be told that when the time comes. You know, we shouldn't really delve into these mysteries. Okay, when they said that, well, I didn't have anything else to do with them as far as asking them, looking for somebody that was searching. And I asked quite a few people and got the same answer out of everybody. Nobody wanted to know where the lost 10 tribes were. They were happy to wait until the prophet told them where the lost 10 tribes were. Curtis, my nephew, who was probably the last person I expected to be a searcher that amounted to anything. when I was a manager at a Wells and Davies Meats, and I got him a job there in the same department where I was a manager over a shipping department. And so I got him a job there. I thought, boy, he's kind of a ne'er-do-well guy, you know. He just wants to get by on the least amount of effort. I didn't have a lot of faith in him at that time. And then after that was over, the company had been in business for 150 years, but it went out of business. So we both lost our jobs. I worked for eight companies in a row that went out of business. Like I say, this one had been in business for 150 years, so you'd think it would be around for a while. But no, it went out of business after I worked for them for about a year.
That's not good to have on your resume.
So, yeah. So I wound up just working for myself, because only by working for myself could I not go out of business. So I worked for myself pretty much ever since. But anyway, when we had to package stuff, I'd look next to him and I had to start work at 5 or 6 in the morning, you know, and he'd come to work and we'd ride together, but when he'd come to work, I'd look at him and he'd he'd be there sleeping, standing up. I had to shake him, and I thought, this guy going to mount anything? And then he moved away, got married, and I heard good stories about him, that he was really successful in sales. He was selling these pots and pans, and one of the top salesmen and everything. Wow, I thought, boy, he seems to be really making something of himself. And then he moved back to New Plymouth, where I was. And when somebody moves in, the ward has had him give a speech. And he gave the speech, and he sounded really good. So I thought, I'm going to invite him over and ask him the key question. So I invited him and his wife over for dinner. And I says, have you ever thought about where the 10 tribes would be? And he says, yeah, I'm really curious. So I explained some of my theories on it. And he found it really interesting. And I thought, aha. Finally, somebody that wants to know something. But just finding somebody that was curious, especially in the church, was very difficult. So I give him this little pamphlet I wrote up about that proves there is progression from one kingdom to another. But the general teaching in the church is once you die and you go to one of the kingdoms, you're stuck there for eternity. Okay? There's no progression. But I use the teachings of Joseph Smith to show, and the scriptures to show, that there was progression. And boy, he thought that was pretty interesting. He goes and shows it to his best friend, who is a really staunch Mormon. And they call me up, and they had a bunch of questions. And then finally one of them asked, well, do you think you're smarter than the prophet? And I says, yeah. And there was silence. There was silence for about 10 seconds. Completely turned his friend off. He thought I was like Satan himself incarnated. But Curtis was still curious. So he says, he came to me and he says, what else do you know? I said, well, quite a few things. And so I explained reincarnation to him. That really threw him for a loop. And he was beside himself for a couple of days, and he prayed about it, and he got a witness that it was true. And from that point on, he was good to go.